Cheers.
It's always fun to start a speech when the chairman's stolen your punchline. Yes, I'm going to talk about happiness. I looked. One gets to do a keynote address by being flattered, and Kerry flattered me and said, "You have a great impact on the atmosphere and how people feel and so on." I said, "Oh yes." But as you approach the conference, you suddenly realise you're going to speak on a subject you know absolutely nothing about, and everybody in the audience knows a great deal more than you. Now, of course, being a politician, that doesn't faze me too much. It's more dangerous in the House of Lords. If you make a speech on defence in the House of Lords, five former chiefs of the defence staff get up after you and put you right. So you do it with some care. But still, I'm here. I've got to make a speech. I know very little about managing human factors risk in that specialist sense, and I know many of you know a great deal about it. As you realise, I have been around and in and responsible for safety-critical industries for my whole career. And indeed now I picked up a little part-time job this year as a non-executive director of the Defence Logistics Organisation, an organisation I've never heard of except for those of you present who belong to it. It's responsible for all the military kit, £85 billion worth of it. And I was walking past the General's office the other day, the chairman, and he said, "You know something about safety, don't you? Will you be our board member that takes a special interest in safety?" And I said yes, rather as I'd said yes to this speech, without thinking a lot about it. Since then, it's been terrifying me. I'm going to start with a statement of belief about safety. And then, as has already been revealed, I'm going to talk about happiness. And then I'm going to come back to the statement of belief about safety. I believe that safety-critical industries that do discharge their safety responsibility well have a number of characteristics. But this is very much my belief. Great chunks of industry do it a different way. But I believe an industry that does it well optimizes its management of safety, doesn't merely comply. It understands the leverage of people in risk, the fact that people have every opportunity to import risk and are uniquely placed to mitigate it. It recognizes that a safety culture comes from the very top to the bottom. It recognizes that risk will only be properly managed where the leader of the industry, the chief executive, understands that he is personally responsible for every individual that comes within his and his industry's duty of care, recognizes that the culture must permeate from him through the layers all the way to the bottom and must be demonstrated all the time, and he must be seen at every level involved in this culture. These industries understand people. They understand that to manage people, you've got to understand them, where they're coming from, what motivates them, how they'll behave. They understand that to get to people, you've got to respect them. You've got to find ways of being equal at every level in the organization. They understand that for people to perform, they have to be supported. And to get the most out of people, you don't threaten them, you motivate them. These businesses, in general, then manage the rest of their business well. They have good relationships with their customers, they have good relations with their staff, they have good relations with society as a whole, and in the long term, they are profitable. That is my belief. Most people here would probably agree with most of what I've just said, but many, many, many companies don't. Many, many companies at the top ask, "What is the law? How do I comply with it? Where's my tick? Now I'll get on with making the money." They are a compliance culture. Why do I believe what I believe? Well, it's partly experience. And experience is a funny thing, because I always remember pilots used to brag about how many hours they'd got. Now, if you've been an airline pilot, especially in the mid-60s, when we, you know, somebody came up on the flight deck when I was a third pilot and said, "What are you?" I said, "I'm a restrictive practice." which absolutely was. In fact, it was the least safe organisation imaginable, because everybody did the same thing all the time. It was before we'd thought about getting crews splitting duties and so on and so forth. But the whole risk, the whole experience thing build up, and it builds up in different ways. The hours and hours with your mind in neutral are not the experience. The experiences are those raw moments of either extreme training or complicated situations you've had to manage or sheer physical emergencies. There the rate of experience is normal. And there is nothing that can increase your experience as fast as the experience I had when I was entering a press conference, clutching my copy of the Fennell Report describing the King's Cross fire, to take a press conference that I was not expecting to do, because my boss and his boss were supposed to do this press conference. The only itsy teeny weeny problem is they'd both been fired. And the only support I got for this press conference was the company lawyer putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, "You realise if you admit liability, you'll screw up the insurance." And I had to apologise to the world for killing 31 people. So at that moment, I learned an awful lot of things. I learned statements like "it would never happen again," simply wouldn't work. And I realised that I had to give the maximum assurance whilst actually making a statement was credible. And I learnt the words "as far as reasonably practical" very rapidly indeed. So my experience all points to my affirmation. But how do I prove it? I can do it by lots and lots of studying, but I'm 63 and I haven't got time. And reflecting on this comment and reflecting on my other world, I thought, is there a philosophical background to the way I believe companies should be managed with respect to risk? And I started to ruminate on my world in politics. Just so you feel really low coming out of this speech, I make the law. You know, dreadful thought, isn't it? And I don't actually do a lot. What it really means is that when the bell goes, I go through the not contents lobby, asking fellow peers, "What are we voting on this time?" But I do listen to debates and occasionally take part in them. And one of the things you find in these debates is people reach out and grab at principles. I mean, the number of times I've had Magna Carta quoted at me, dreadful. I mean, I've actually read the damn thing in translation end to end, and apart from being a deeply anti-Semitic document that actually lasted 3 months, it doesn't add much. There's only two clauses left, and one of which that's about speedy justice, and anybody who's been involved with the justice system knows we don't achieve that. So you get this principle grabbing thing, and this annoys me, because you can see philosophical themes going through the decision. So I've spent some time thinking about what are these philosophical themes, and I want to share them with you today, because I think at the end of the day they help point to how we manage everything, and are particularly apposite as to how we manage safety. And the theme, or the most way out of the theme, is the concept of happiness. Happiness is not been something you could talk about in respectable company. I mean, it was sort of soft stuff. You know, it's about getting on and being more productive and creating wealth, and that's all respectable. But happiness has been a sort of bit of a taboo subject. It's having a renaissance, and I call it a renaissance because it was a very, very fashionable subject. Towards the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, the philosophers felt this was an important. And the most important philosopher of that period was Jeremy Bentham, who was involved at University College London. And he had this concept of the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And he believed that this could be a guiding principle for all decision-making. And the modern work is helpful, in part at least, to supporting that general concept. I say it's helpful in the sense that we now know, because there's quite a lot of research been done into happiness, is that it is a pretty clear concept. It doesn't sound very clear at first, but basically most people can respond pretty sensibly to comparative questions. For instance, are you happier today than you were yesterday? The very simple idea of I feel happy is measurable. The causes of happiness, of course, are as complex as society as a whole. But because you can measure it, there's quite a lot of time series data on it, because we can now look at the brain, and the way the brain reacts when we are happy is extraordinarily measurable. One chunk gets all excited when you're happy, another chunk gets all excited when you're unhappy. It's very similar, simple, linear thing. And therefore, it's not a bad idea. And it does translate into a whole series of behaviours. It translates in not the simple idea of laughing at a comedy show, but it's the happiness that comes from parenthood. It's the happiness that comes from being part of a society where you feel comfortable. It's the happiness that comes from the more complex ideas of being involved in moral crusades or whatever. So it's a big idea covering a lot of things. So Jeremy Bentham wrote books on this. He has this lovely word which I shall not get away with trying to pronounce. He called it the philosophic calculus. I only saw that word yesterday. It really means the calculus of happiness. And he, most of his work, he used the word happiness. In other times, he used the word good. And it's important to recognise that happiness isn't simply a positive vector, it's the relief of a negative vector. So it is the relief of unhappiness, as is important in Jeremy Bentham's general idea of the greatest happiness for the greatest number. For instance, peculiarly, it's very difficult to make rich people happier. I mean, a chunk of people in here, especially those of us who have retired from the airline industry, are frankly rich, you know. Sorry about that, it's true. And actually making me happier, I'm a pretty grumpy person, I admit, but actually making me happy is very difficult. Whereas if you look at society as a whole, there are great chunks of unhappiness. Poverty, physical ill health, and worst of all, as far as one can see from the data, mental ill health. Mental ill health is an enormous source of unhappiness, and it's incredibly widespread. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all ashamed to talk about it. But something like one in four of us will have an experience of depression at some point in their lives, and they will touch upon that dreadful feeling of nothingness and vacancy and so on. And imagine if you're seriously depressed and it goes on for days and weeks, and we know what happens to some of those people, they commit suicide. So happiness is about relieving unhappiness. And of course this is how it relates to us, because safety is about relieving risk, it's about taking away the chance of harm to people, it's about not actually harming people. So the first principle, which is this lovely Jeremy Bentham saying, the greatest happiness, greatest number, the greatest good for the greatest number, say it how you like. Trouble is, I mean, if we had a world of infinite resources, it wouldn't be a problem, would it? Because send you all out and you'd just pick the goodies off the tree that you wanted. So the next idea one has to bring into this decision-making tool is the idea of finite resources. The world has finite resources, and therefore the concept of the greatest good for the greatest number is about proportionality. It's about where resource is applied, where within the society that you're considering in your happiness debate, that you should apply that resource to create the greatest number concept. So as a concept, we now have to build on the greatest happiness, greatest number. We have to say the greatest happiness for the greatest number within the finite resources available to us. Another problem with Bentham's concept is its implicit equity. It assumes all human beings have an equal right, if that's the right term. I worry about the word right, but within the concept, it assumes each human being has an equal right to happiness. In that sense, that every person is equal. Now, frankly, we don't behave like that. And therefore, you're left to a degree with a question mark over a theory which describes a non-experienced behaviour. Does it matter? Well, when I come to describe where you need this theory, it tends to be in the areas where we are most comfortable about treating people as equal. For instance, health is a classic example. At least in state provision, we tend to want to behave as if all individually. So it doesn't really break into the concept too strongly. The next problem with Bentham's theories is that there are winners and losers. And this is the real modern world, and this is why being close to, I won't really claim to be part of the lawmaking process, but close to the lawmaking process, you see all the time that in a very complex world, whenever you try to do something, quotes, good, it will have a bad effect elsewhere. Now, Bentham, of course, is comfortable with that idea because he said, yes, but it's the net effect that matters. And, of course, that is a very good test. Except there's a limit to just how evil one should be to the losers in order to enable the winners. Even if the arithmetic says, well, the winners... I mean, should you encourage people to smoke cigarettes so that they die neatly at 66 just where they're going to be a drain on the treasury? They've done a great contribute to the treasury, you know, boom, dead 66, out the way, great life, thank you very much. Well, no, we don't, we think that's wrong. We think there's a sense that losers should be protected. Don't kid yourself, there are no losers. I mean, a lot of people here are in the aviation business, and if you live in that nice house at the end of the proposed runway, you know you are a loser. And society will overrule you, because society will say we need aviation, it's great for wealth, it's great for pollution as well. Never mind, don't say that. Wealth generation requires growth in the aviation, is that you, my friend, are a loser. Much more personally, there's a real probability that a vast number of people in this room, if not a majority, will at some point be denied a drug because that money is deemed to be better spent on another drug with another person that will be more efficient. And indeed, frankly, the National Health Service is very good at this. I mean, it's better than beaten up rotten. But the whole concept of how it works out what treatments shall be allowed and what treatments are not allowed are handled by NICE. It's now got another letter in it, and I can't remember what it is. But it was the National Institute for Clinical Ethics. It's not really the National Institute for Clinical Ethics. It's the National Institute of Medical Rationing. And it does a very good job. And if you meet them at an event like this, and if you poke them hard enough, because they don't advertise it, they will say, we make our decisions on £25,000 to £35,000 per quality life year. So that's what you're worth, folks, in the national conscience, £25,000 to £35,000 per quality life year. And you, as an individual, stand a very good chance at some point in your life being a loser. Now, how do we cope with this loser weakness of the general theory? Well, you then get the other bunch, and really they do get up my nose, and that's the human rights bunch. I'm sorry, I'm a perfectly nice chap, I don't want to lock you all up. But why do we need this? Well, they don't think through why we need human rights, why we need minority rights. We need it to balance up this general calculus. We need it to say there are basic things we will not do to people. So, for instance, when they're going to build the runway at the end of your garden, they will take your land away in the final analysis, but they'll pay you for it. And hopefully they'll pay you fairly reasonably. So society has a conscience about losers in that sense. And therefore it's important to balance up the general theorem that Bentham had with a minority theorem. And then finally, there's the problem of the universe. In what universe are we making our judgment? Because if you make a judgment in the universe of the whole world, it's difficult to believe we would not be facing radically different lifestyles as our wealth was transferred, particularly to Africa, but to many other countries in the world, where resources are clearly unfairly balanced with our own. We all know in our hearts of hearts, we might have a little twinge of shame as I say that, but we all know in our hearts of hearts that decisions are made in different universes, and society can only cope with particular sizes of universe within which any... And it can be as small as the family, it can be as the firm, it can be other groupings. I remember being taught when I was in Balpa and in the middle of a palace coup, the local officials say, this doesn't compare with our operatic society. You know, groupings of people and behaviours and universes can be of all sorts of sizes, but they're quite important in the way we behave, and we have to respect that. So I'm offering a tool, a universal tool for decision making. It's a tool that has the greatest happiness for the greatest number. It's a tool that recognises that resources are finite, therefore decisions are about proportions. And it's a tool that recognises the rights of minorities. It's a tool that recognises that the universe within which the decision is made is practical. How does this work in practice? I mean, does it? Yes, lovely. Well, I hope you think it's quite a credible bit of theory. I mean, filled in 15 minutes. How does it work in practice? Let's first look at where decisions are made about big universes most. And that is at the level of the state. Sometimes, quite frequently these days, in the level of the superstate. I mean, much of our law is made in the European Union. What sort of laws do we make? Well, very crudely, I put to you, there are three sort of groupings. It's not deeply analytical, but there are three sort of groupings. And the first group is regulation. And there's an awful lot of debate about regulation these days, and I suppose I'm relatively politically in the centre of this debate. What is regulation for? Now, I know if you're in the middle of it, and many of you are in the middle of it, regulation frequently feels as though it's there to keep the regulators in a job. And there's a great regulation industry, be it safety, be it the environment, be it legal regulation. The whole of law is in itself a regulation industry. And any of you paid a lawyer have to believe that we're in the lawyering business, not in the justice business. So, yes, there is an industry about regulation, but what should a politician, part of the executive, be thinking when they make a regulation? Well, it's very simple. You go back to the Benthamite principle. Does the burden that this regulation introduces, is that burden less than the wider benefit that it brings to all stakeholders in the firm, in the enterprise, in whatever is being regulated? Because if the answer is not that it is less, it should not be made. And indeed, if there's a regulation that brings more burden than benefit, it should be scrapped. And that's what, when you go right into the middle of it all, you find that regulations do try to do that. They do try. You wouldn't believe it when you listen to some of the debates. But basically, and of course if you've read any regulations recently, you'll know they're accompanied by a regulatory impact assessment, which once again tries this Benthamite test of, is the limitation that this regulation introduces, which will in itself protect wider society from the narrow activity of this enterprise or whatever, is that burden less than the benefit? Secondly, what do we do? Well, we provide services, health, schools, so on and so forth. It's very interesting that this sort of tool that I've described is exactly the tool, well, not exactly, sorry, experts say a very dangerous word, is quite close, as far as I can see, to the tools the health service are more and more trying to use in making their decisions about resources. Is the money that we spend here, is it appropriate to... Does it bring more benefit than the same money spent some other way? It's very, very complicated sum, but the idea is really, really quite simple. The area which is a bit iffier is the whole issue of wealth and money. Does society, does government and so on, does it interfere in our lives to significantly take money from the very happy to assign it to the very unhappy? Well, in part, we have a progressive taxation system, but there is a sort of acceptance by governments that progressive taxation systems can only go so far. And it's quite interesting. There's no real debate that taxation systems should be progressive. The only debate is about, you know, where do they tail off? Where do they flatten off? And once again, there is pretty well a consensus. I would put to you that taxation in the sense of top-level personal taxation won't be a big issue at the next election. it won't be a big issue. There is a more or less a consensus about the shape of taxation. So I think the tool I've described works reasonably well at the level of the state. Even if we don't use the tool, we actually recognise the issues. We recognise the ideas of universes, you know, to whom does this apply? We recognise the concept of finite wealth. We recognise the greatest good for the greatest numbers. We recognise winners and losers. I mean, I have spent hours listening to the rights of 14 terrorists in Belmarsh. Absolutely hours. And, you know, it's very difficult to believe that going as far as we do in pursuit of human rights actually matches up the general good. But in general, we were with it. How many firms run themselves this way? Well, it's difficult to know. The concepts I've been talking about are often captured in things like corporate social responsibility, enlightened shareholder responsibility. A number of firms talk about it. They frequently set up departments for it, which is always slightly worrying. But some firms, and a firm that clearly thinks it's turning it into a successful business philosophy is BP. You'll see every advertisement for BP now almost apologises for selling petrol. I mean, you see the prices of BP at the pump, you can see why, but nevertheless, BP is almost apologising for selling petrol. It says, we've got to sell petrol because we're in the petrol business, but we're going to be in all these businesses that are going to be great for the planet and so on. And I really think they have absorbed the idea. I'm interested anybody who knows them well enough to know whether it's true or not. But all too frequently, we're just talking about the duty to the shareholder. Interestingly, there's going to be a 2006 Companies Act, and that Companies Act will actually put in law the wider duties of directors beyond the shareholder. And so the law is also recognising that the simple pursuit of shareholder value is in itself unacceptable. There has to be some constraint. What's all this got to do with safety? What's wrong with compliance? How would a happiness firm tackle safety? Well, firstly, it would see happiness as the reduction of risk. It would see reducing risk as a good thing. It would see that promising to reduce the likelihood of harm to people to whom it has a duty of care as a happiness activity. You might think it would then have a problem of dealing with that, because how will I measure how much happiness, I mean, how much reduction in risk should I do? Well, there's some pretty good stuff about. The railway industry, the nuclear industry, and so on, have all been willing to debate the cost of an avoided fatality. The working figure in the railway industry used at the moment is about £1.5 million per life. That fits remarkably well with the £35,000 per year that NICE used. I mean, you just multiply 35 by 30 or 40 or something, and you're in the £1-1.5 million range. The figures are derived by willingness to pay studies. I mean, this is dodgy stuff, because it's very difficult to ask somebody what their life's worth. But it is very easy to watch people's behaviour. For instance, I know nobody who crosses a road directly perpendicular to the pavement, which is overwhelmingly the safest way of doing it. It minimises the exposure to the traffic, and it means you can see the traffic equally well from both directions. Does anybody do it? Do they, hell? You see people run for tube trains. Why do you run for a tube train? There's going to be another one in 2 minutes. Probably got less people on it. Yeah, but we do. We take risks. We drive. Sadly, some of us in our youth used to drive when we'd been drinking. We took that risk. We took that risk with our own life. But even worse, we took that risk with somebody else's life. So we do have a concept of life not being infinitely valued. And we do demonstrate in our behaviour. So you can do work to measure what those behaviours are actually saying. And you end up, and many would say this is the central idea of the 1974 Health and Safety at Work Act, that you are duty-bound to reduce risk to as low as reasonably practical. Now, it comes under a lot of attack, and a lot of it, and sadly, in some cases, health and safety has become a term of derision because it's not intelligently handled. But the idea of the proportionality in the ALARP concept is quite powerful. So what next characteristic would I see of this happiness-orientated firm handling safety? Well, because it's an important thing, i.e. the reduction of risk, it would be owned by the top. It would be on the chief executive's agenda. Not only on his agenda, it would be in his or her mind. It would be part of everything this firm did. We are talking about industries in the safety critical area, obviously, but it would be in the mind of everybody. They would want to optimize the management of risk. Why would they want to optimize the management of risk? Because that way you become safer. If you learn how to mitigate a risk more cheaply, that means there is more resource to attack other risks and make the whole firm safer. So your firm thinks all the time about risk, thinks of it as part of its total management process, as how it does it, takes every possible advantage to optimize risk as a holistic management process. So you'd become an optimizing business. If you want to be a successful business, you've got to be in the optimizing business anyway, certainly if you're in any way a process or a continuous business. So into your total optimizing process, you bring risk. You inevitably turn to people. People have such an enormous capability to import risk. It doesn't matter how much you've engineered risk out. If you let a human being within 1,000 meters of that facility, they can bring with them risk. They can go and touch something. They can go and do something they shouldn't do, and they can cause absolute chaos. No matter what you do, the only way you can attack that issue is with the people themselves. The people have to understand the risk, have to understand their part in the risk, and so on. And the bonus you get for that is that you will get your risk better managed, because those people understand much better than the chief executive or the engineering director or whatever, much better where the risk is and how it can be best managed. And by capturing their hearts and souls, those people will make your business even safer, even happier. Your business would hence become very people's focus. And I believe in any business that's virtually any business, but particularly businesses which have a public face, which have a public reputation, your people-focused, your motivated, not threatened people make you successful in the eyes of other stakeholders. But would you make money? Would this business not become an absolute glorious failure? That is the worry, and it is a worry which, frankly, turns many, many businesses into compliance businesses, not optimizing businesses. And this is where, to make this work, you have to have a partnership with the state. And in many ways, I've been out of the business for 20-odd years, but looking at it far, aviation largely succeeds. Because what the state wants to do, because it's in the happiness business, and what you as the happiness company want to do, are very much the same thing. You both want to reduce risk to as low as reasonably practical. The difference is that you, the firm, are better at it because you know your business. And your partnership with the state is for them to bring in behind you regulation that cuts out the free rider, so that the regulation and what the good firm does are very similar. And in general, you will do it better because you understand it. You will do it better than your competitor, who simply complies because they don't understand why or how they're doing it. So a partnership with the state, I think, is an essential relationship for a society to encourage free firms to work in this optimizing way. The regulation is by creating this sort of atmosphere. Your safety burden goes right back to the Benthamite test. Is the burden equal or less? Is the burden equal or less than your competitors? Is the burden less than the value it brings? So what does the firm look like? This firm has stakeholder respect because people like seeing people manage positively, not defensively. It has good safety management systems. If it's got good safety management systems, it's probably going to get good management systems, because frankly, a good safety management system is little different from a good management system. You describe a good safety management system, you go into another room, somebody's describing a good management system, and other than the heading, you usually can't tell the difference because the processes are the same. This is a firm that's got motivated, innovative staff. They see, as they're seeing safety advantage, they're seeing performance out. This firm, in my view, will not lose money. This firm will, in fact, be as successful or more successful than its competitors that are living by compliance. I started off by saying, I believe the perfectly managed firm in a safety critical environment optimises its safety responsibility, doesn't just comply. The risks are owned at the very top of the business. The firm understands the leverage of people to import risk. It understands the leverage of people to mitigate risk. It recognises that safety culture has to come from the top, permeate through every layer to every part of the team. It understands the key to working with people is to understand them, not treat them all the same, recognise people come from different places. The great thing about people is they're not normal. Nobody's normal, everybody's different. Very important. These firms respect the people they work with, respect people within the firm. They know the importance of supporting their people, and they know the importance of motivating these people. These firms have, in general, contented customers, contented staff with them, and in the long term they're profitable. Why do I believe that's true? Well, I believe it through experience. But it's also, I believe, true because I now, upon reflection, think it's ethically sound. Safety management is very simple. You've got to get your thinking straight, you've got to get your leadership sound, and you've got to deliver it through people. Thank you.